either their parents or by our environment or whatever, and these definitions of who we are determine just how much we expect of ourselves, and consequently we never live beyond those expectations. My feeling about life in general and about this class in specific is what I want to do is push you beyond those limitations. I want to stretch you. Once you stretch 2, 3, 4 times, you'll start accepting the fact that I am capable of stretching. I'm capable of doing more than I thought I was capable of doing. In which case, you will live up to your potential, which is what you want to do. It's what I would like for you to do, and it's what I want to do for myself. So in a way, this is a course that I use to image myself the whole time I do it. So when I push, when I shove, when I say things that are wrong, or when I even offend, I do that as a way of stretching, not just because I have to be some neurotic person who likes to take pleasure out of causing pain to other people. Thank you for calling me a nerd.
You're welcome. Well, after the airhead comment last week, a lot of us are really great conscious, and we're really worried about what people think, and we're also very sensitive if there's even one slightly negative comment. And that's really hard for you to deal with if you don't take the perspective that Lori's giving you. You're working on yourself, and we're not grading you for being a good kid in a good class. That's not the issue. So I think we need to get into a discussion of grading and what the purpose of these projects is all about. Again, although we previously discussed it.
Yeah, but I can understand how you couldn't hear it before because you didn't know what it was you were doing exactly. Now you know what it was you're doing, and you say, how does this measure up to a grading system? Well, if I may be so bold as to sort of jump in here.
Go ahead.
A grading system there originally was placed as a way of determining for yourself how well you were performing within a specific context, in a classroom context. So oftentimes what that meant is you were given information, and then you were tested to find out if that information sank in, if you knew what that information was. In a normal kind of system, when all that is very specific kinds of data, you can regurgitate that data, and we could all figure out what that is, and then you know yourself whether or not you've done well. This kind of a class deals with data as well, but the data is very subjective. So it's not information in terms of facts, but it's information in terms of process. What we try and do is to develop new processes, not new specific data. So it's hard for you to understand those processes because you've never thought about that before, but we can see that. We can see if you are really committing yourself to the journals, which is the thing that we talked about before. We can see if you are stretching your own processes. We can see if you are asking questions. We can see if you are making connections. And it's not an objective thing where we compare Lori's journal to Theo's journal. We don't do that. What we do is we compare you to yourself. We're really reasonably perceptive people, and so what we try and do is look at what you're writing, look at your participation in class, look at the shrines that you're doing, and kind of see how you're pushing yourself to make those connections to see what's going on. And if you're having trouble, we either try and get a hold of you, or we encourage you to get a hold of us. Although sometimes you may come and we're busy, or sometimes you may come to our rooms and we're not there, Holden is not that large of a place. If you really wanted to talk to us, you'd be able to find us without any trouble at all. And that's what we really want you to do. If we had more time, we would talk to all of you at length. I mean, I've had some conversations with people that have lasted well into the wee hours of the morning, and I appreciate that and desire more things like that. That's the kind of thing that we have to share here. Anyway, when I heard that people were getting really grade conscious, I got angry. I got angry, and I want to share that anger with you a bit. I don't mean to scare you, but I want you to realize how offended I was about that. That this is, I mean, grades are bullshit. They always were, and they always will be, no matter how anyone tells you differently. It's a gauge that means nothing. When you get out into the world, and you're out there thinking back at your college life, you're not going to remember anything in the classes that you got A's in, most of the time. The things you're going to remember are the social interaction you had with friends, those amazing discussions on philosophy and theology that you bumped into from time to time, and all the girls and boyfriends that you might have spent some time with. And those are really the things that are most important. So to me, this class gives you a capacity to understand yourself and make a difference in your life. No matter what careers you go into, no matter what information you learn, it has nothing to do with grades. So for me, Kate and I and PLU and the Integrated Studies Program have given you a very nice gift. And the best way to appreciate that gift is to get into it and commit yourself to it and forget about grades. I mean, really, Kate and I would be much more comfortable not giving grades. And so we spent a lot of time trying to give specific, or as specific as we could, evaluations of your performance in the context of the journal. And to hear rumors that the only thing people worried about is how it can be graded means that, number one, no one listened to what we wrote. Number two, no one listened to what they wrote in their own journal. And three, no one was paying attention to each other. So that was sort of my response to it. And I need to sort of get it out so I don't have to think about it anymore. And I want to just kind of let you know where I'm coming from. And I, without really talking too much about to Kate about it, I don't think she was angry, but I think she felt pretty much similar to me. So when you have a problem, you come and you talk about it. We're adults. And I think that's the essential part of this, is to take control of your own imaging, take control of yourselves, and come recognize it and let it all out. There are a lot of you here who will help anybody else. I mean, that's the neat thing about this group. When I walked up into where the Shines were going, I was amazed at the cooperation that was going on, the support that was going on. Someone was having a problem, they were getting a pat on the back, a few suggestions, and a lot of sort of calming advice. That's an amazing kind of thing that you're not going to experience often in your lives as they're structured now. So use it and take advantage of it. And I'm rambling, so I think maybe I should just stop. Kate, do you want to say anything?
Yeah, how do you guys feel about what Lori just said? Lisa, I believe I think that is the best thing that I've heard probably today so far. I am probably one of the guiltiest people here in terms of where your anger is directed at, in that my whole life I have been so directed at getting the grade, getting the A, being worried about the GPA, being worried about what everybody thinks about me, being worried about making the impression on the adult. And that is, frankly, to take your quote, that is bullshit. And it's hard for me because in my head I know that. You know, I know that, but inside it's like I've done it for so long that I can't, I try to stop it. And I don't know, it's like sometimes I need somebody to say, look, you know, and that was real important for me to hear that. And so I think I can go on with the last 3 weeks of class and feel a little bit, at least a little bit freer about that. It'll still be a struggle for me, but at least, you know, I can try to let go of some of that. Me too. We go back to school and there's chemistry, but
you
know.
Todd, did you
want to say something? Page 176, about the middle of the page, Zen and the Art of Motorcycle made the comment about grades. And it fits beautifully with what you just said. The book is this guy's writing, telling you about his experiences of teaching college, and where he was saying, school teaches you to imitate. If you want good grades, you do a good job of imitating the teacher. There was no basis for originality in being your own self within the classroom setting as we have it, because of the whole structure of the grade. It fits beautifully with what Laura was saying about imaging the self. We're trying to see what is imaged our own individual self.
By the way, that's another great book that should be on the book, the recommended book list. If you want to add another book to it.
You just have to keep remembering that grades are the only thing you're seeking water to do.
That's an excellently phrased.
I think just about everybody here would agree with that and understand that. And I mean, I think what people are feeling though is the pressure. You know, when we get out of college, is to get the jobs that we want. You know, is the people look at our GPAs and stuff, and it's frustrating.
You want to know a secret?
We feel that way too, but it's like.
I'll tell you a secret. That is a big myth. When you get a job, it's going to have zilch to do with your GPA. Absolutely zilch.
I disagree with that.
It's not my experience. I've never had anyone look at my GPA as a way of giving me a job or not giving me a job. It's been an excuse to not give me a job, but it's not because they lost it. It was just the kind of thing, well, I don't want to give this guy a job and this is going to be the reason why, or something like that.
I think the thing is that you have to realize, I mean, don't just go, you know, I mean, you know, put forth the effort,
can't blow it off.
But the important thing is that if you don't, I mean, if you know, if you get a C, or if you get a B, just go, hey, but I learned so much that I don't think you can even consider this class in the same category as other classes. It just isn't the same. There's so much more you can get out of it than a grade that you have to just step back and look at it and say, you know, if I don't make grad school, I'm still a better person for it.
The funny thing about grad school is that's probably the first time many of you will have to think for yourselves, and what we're doing is giving you a leg up on that.
There's a whole lot of hands up, so I don't know who's going first here.
Tom.
Okay, Tom.
I just want to know, why isn't this class pass-fail? It seems like a perfect candidate for a pass-fail class.
And because it has to do with, I think, with what they, how you use pass-fail classes in the context of majors and stuff. So I think that's what it's all about.
You're right. I know some education classes are strictly pass-fail. It seems like a good class.
Well, yeah, if you're interested in that, when we get back to PLU, we can, you know, fill out a form.
No.
But if you can just forget about it, we'll give you a better grade almost. That's
the point.
So if you start worrying about it, if you try to think of it that way, I know I have struggles with it as well. But I find sometimes that if I try to forget about it completely, you know, as much as I can, that I end up doing at least as good or better than I would have done, and I pick up a lot more.
And so my feeling is that if you have that conflict, then the best thing to do is really think about what that means. Let me share a little bit personally about it. I know that I am not in an academic field. I'm in art in that sense. And that maybe gives me a little more leeway, but I think that leeway is more mythical than real, although I'm sure engineers and pre-med students have a different kind of thing. But I'll talk about that another time. It took me 7.5 years to get my undergraduate degree. I was kicked out of school once. I was almost kicked out of school another time, all because of grades. But what happened about it? I mean, it's true I had to struggle. I didn't get to a job that I wanted to be at right away. But the thing that made it really important to me is what I learned between then and now is so much more valuable than almost everybody else I see in an analogous position in my profession. It gives me a lot, not only a lot more to give, but I also get a lot more. And in the process is that if I lost my job tomorrow, I still would be so happy about who I am and where I am that the money is just garbage. Yeah, you can say to yourself that I want to have this nice house and I want to be comfortable. We're all children of the middle class. We're not going to not be comfortable. But I think to use that money to buy out your commitment to your own morality, your commitment to your own spirit, your commitment to your own integration in life, is casting away your one chance, at least this lifetime, to actually live the life that you all mouth about on Sunday mornings or when we're having those spiritual conversations. So it's real important to use this opportunity to try and bring those two things together, or at least let them spark enough to ask and demand some things about yourself. The thing that's most important about that is not to necessarily make yourself live a dogma, because that's only going to make you really unhappy. But to recognize that these are two aspects of yourself that are real. Neither of them need to be thrown out, but they need to somehow be merged in some open-ended kind of way. A way that will allow you to be able to see yourself for who you are, not who you think you want to be, not who others want you to be, and not who you're afraid you're going to become. Those are the kind of three things that often determine how we sail our ship through life. The other thing I was talking about earlier, and this is the last I'm going to say about it from this point of view, is I was talking to Annette, and she was worried about a piece of her shrine breaking before she brought it over here. She was concerned about what it's going to look like. And I look at that again as a metaphor for how we go through lives, is we have this construct about how we think it's going to be, and we carefully build these little sandcastles. And then we spend all this time worrying and ruminating about how they're not going to make it, how they're not going to survive, how they're going to be different than what we think they were going to be. The reality is, nothing is going to be what we want it to be. It's going to become whatever it is. And so what you need to do is look at what it becomes as a metaphor for who you are and how you can solve that problem. There are lessons all the time. Your life is going to be completed, going to be filled with lessons. And the more you don't address individual issues, the more you don't confront that idea of faith and integration, the bigger and more painful those lessons are going to become. So see them. Accept what there is. See it as another way of learning who you are. And accept that. Don't fight it. And the grades are another one of those things. Chances are, if you're doing what you want to do, you're going to love what you're doing, and most of the time, you're going to get good grades. Every once in a while, you're going to have a really weird faculty person who you're not going to get along with, or a class that's really boring, and you may not. I don't know. It hasn't affected me, anyway. I got into graduate school. I got National Endowment grants. I got TAs. I got scholarships. It didn't matter. Because where I was focusing my life, which was in my art, I did well. I think that's going to be the case with most people. In fact, there's a whole book written about how rich people make money. Most people who are really wealthy, not upper middle class people, I mean people who really make a difference in their lives, are doing something they love to do, and it just incidentally makes them money. They don't go out to get rich. They go out to do what they want to do. Most people who go out to get rich are people who die of heart attacks when they're 45, are people who are so stressed out in their job that all they're doing is fantasizing about how they can get out of it, how they can get out of work. They're people who drink a lot of money, have a lot of affairs, and feel very unfulfilled about what they're doing.
Most people who go out only for grades need it that way, and why?
Anyway, I'm done. Again.
I really appreciated that last time.
I feel exhausted now. Are there any other questions or comments? I mean, this is a really good discussion. I'm having a great time.
I think one good example that I really like that just came to mind is the one with Russell Baker when he, you know, when he thought what he was going to do was going to be it. He was going to fail it with his writing assignment. But he decided to do it anyway, just for himself, and it ended up being the best thing that he's done.
Yeah. Last October, we went to a lot of work trying to come up with what would be good, quote-unquote, projects or assignments. These are not the kind of assignments that are easy to grade. Well, should we drop them because they're not easy to grade? No, that's not the point. The point is that you do something that ties it with imaging yourself.
I think that's really true, too, is I have a lot of you are sort of worried. Did you ever handle that? A lot of you were worried about, gee, I'm not really creative. You know, I'm really worried about doing something because I'm not going to be creative. You haven't used that sort of part of yourself. And I look around at what I see here, and I'm amazed at the amount of creative energy and creative potential that exists in all of us, every last one of us. And I think, if nothing else, I think if you look at the class in that same way, sort of say to yourself, if all of us had met in that one room, when we first had our introductory meeting, and we said, okay, let's do an art project. I mean, how many of you would just sort of walk right out the door? Thought, I can't do it. I haven't done it in so long, I can't do it. A good number of you would have just said, nah, forget it. And I look at this stuff, and most of this stuff is better than what comes out of the art program. Because the art program is just another one of those grade factors. It has nothing to do with really addressing those personal issues. So whenever I do an ISP program class like this, I'm amazed at the group of artists that there are. It's that other thing. God, I'm doing it again. It's about talent. And we all assume that when you go out in the world, you're either intelligent enough to be, and so that gives you a leg up, or you have this great gift. God gave you this gift and you have this talent. That's another one of those myths. There is no such thing as talent is something that you either have or you don't have. It's something you either choose to develop or are compelled to develop or not. And so you all have it. If I would take any one of you, and it wouldn't matter which one, and I would put you into some kind of a situation where I could really get you to be an artist, you would be. And get you to be a musician, I think you would be.
You'd even start thinking that you were.
That's right. And when I say artist or musician, that's not me. I don't mean that in the context of whether you're going to become a great concert pianist. I mean, some of the most wonderful musicians we have could never be a concert pianist. Because that's skill more than it is creativity. I'm talking about real, raw, creative energy, the kind of thing that allows you to kind of make connections to things and communicate your feelings and your humanness to other people. You all have amazing potential that way, amazing potential. And the longer I live, the more I see how that's there and how we sell ourselves short over and over and over again. I'm done again.
Marty didn't get his journal.
There's a couple journals right there. I don't know if that's...
None of those are Marty's.
None of those are Marty's. Okay, we'll look and see if it's around.
Sorry, Marty.
I know. know I remember, but I'm sure I wrote that. We'll dig it up.
It's probably in my room.
It was a real hot journal, wasn't it? Anyway.
I just had to read it again. It was so much fun.
Kind of figuring out how we can present information and how we can communicate with you guys. And I know that you guys do a lot in terms of trying to communicate back to us, but the way this class works is by pulling out as many stops as you can. It doesn't mean pulling out stops you're not comfortable with pulling out. I would not ask you to share anything that you really can't share. But anytime that you self-edit, I think it's sort of like the pre-writes, anytime you self-edit, you are eliminating an important part of that mirror that will show you back who you really are, not who you think you are. So try not to do that. Don't worry about if you're going to offend us, because chances are, even if we get personally offended, which is not likely, we won't hold it against you. Someone had talked to me before about dreams and how much you can really share about dreams, because we all know sometimes dreams get to be something you don't usually like talking about very much, for one reason or another that I shall not mention. Well, both Kate and I have sort of lived fairly rich and open lives. I think we kind of know and can handle most things. So if you dream it and you want to record it, not for us, but for yourselves, then I think you should do it. Don't worry about what it is. Because there's nothing you're going to write that's going to be weird to us. Nothing you're going to write that we haven't probably experienced in our own dreams. And in fact, when we talk about dreams, we're going to share a couple of those with you just to really shake your foundation. So really let it out. This is maybe the only opportunity you're going to have for a long time when you can start yourself on that road. Because every place else, when you go into the world, people are going to tell you what you can't do and what you can't share and what they don't want to hear and how you can't behave. Here, for the most part, you can do anything you want. Of course, that means you should be open to the responses you get from people by doing it, but that's also part of the game. So go ahead and do it. I mean, also, I'm a human being, just like you guys. You all need a hug from time to time. You all need to know what somebody else thinks of you. You all want to know if you're doing something that's wrong. We're people. We need to see that and hear that and feel that as well. We oftentimes, God, I'm doing it again. But oftentimes you go into class and you figure, here's the teacher right here, right? This is the authority figure. This is your institutionalized parent. And then here's you guys, all down over here, little kind of chicks. Well, this guy up here, whether they're going to admit it to you or not, whether they're giving you a power trip or not, is a human being, a flesh and blood person who loves and hates and has to go to the bathroom and eats and sleeps at night and probably has a screwed up relationship with someone anyway. And what he needs to know, what she needs to know, is what is really going on, how people really are responding to them, how people really are feeling. That person never gets that information. That person's never going to get a chance to grow and develop. That person may be 40 years old and has never even thought about living up to their potential, and you have a gift you can give them.
That's taking a risk.
Yeah, it's taking a risk, and chances are they're not going to like it. But that doesn't matter. You don't do it just for them, you do it for the experience of being able to be that kind of honest and open person. It comes back to you, it does. It may not come back to you that night, that day, that semester, but it comes back to you. You gain interest, and the interest rate is a real good one.
Dare to risk.
Did you say that louder?
The trial and body. Who are yours?
This is my favorite subject, but I really do start boring people after a while. Did we have any? Oh, black elk. I think we're done with black elk.
Yeah.
I'll see if you commented on it. How do you feel about that?
Well, rats. I mean, you were so good on Russell Baker. I was looking forward to another really good.
Well, I have all those notes, but...
Can we do a few comments on the song that you hear in an app? Okay, that's fine. We can talk about that later. I mean, that's fine.
Okay, I'm open to having a conversation out of class, too. We can do that, except this afternoon I'm really going to be struggling to get my dream notes together for tonight. Also for tonight, since I'm doing a community presentation on dreams, it'll be more of a discussion. Much of the information we'll be covering tonight we'll also be covering in class. Is it tomorrow?
Yeah.
I keep forgetting. So you don't have to come. In fact, if you don't come, then I'll feel more like I can fill the time up tomorrow, but keep yourself on that. Okay. I suppose it's time to deal with the shrines and talk about a few guidelines. I was thinking to myself this morning as I was in the shower singing away that...
we noticed.
The walls are very thin. And I haven't shared this with you, but it's fairly easy. And I just want to throw it up to see how you feel about it. Is that with 19 of them, we can all ascribe a number to ourselves, just sort of count down, get a number. Then what happens is half of us writes on one group of number, five, say, yeah, and the other one groups writes on the other half of number, so we write on each other. And then we write on five more that we haven't been asked to write on, that we, or let's say three more, so that we can respond to some favorite one that we see around. So we have to write on some of them, even if we don't want to, and we elect to write on others. That way you guys get to write on, let's see, there are 19 of us, and that's roughly 10. That means you roughly say write on 12 of them, let's say, as opposed to 19. Is that too high a number still, do you think?
Sure.
We can divide you into three sections. Kind of things you learn from a process like this. Oftentimes, when you're creating something, there's a part of you that's extremely conscious about what you're creating, and a part of you that that nurtures that awareness. And there's another part that is activated in the process of creativity that develops into that thing I call synergy, which is where you're actually saying things that you never even knew you had to say, saying things you never even knew were there to be said, expressing feelings you never knew you had, putting things together in ways that communicate stuff that you're not conscious of. And the wonderful thing about all art is that what it does is it communicates to us in ways, or from us even, in ways that we cannot explain and cannot understand. When we look at some artist's work and some art historian is telling you about how this means this and this symbolizes that, odds are that artist didn't have anything in mind like that when they did it, but they communicated it anyway. So when you're looking at your shrines, your own or others, you're going to see things about that the person who made it didn't even know they put in. So when you get your feedback from other people and they see something, they sort of didn't get the point. Maybe you had a symbol that meant a particular thing, and they thought it meant something else. Don't dismiss that as being wrong. Open yourself up to what that information is, because maybe they're seeing something that you can't become consciously aware of, that you're not quite yet willing to look at. That's the wonderful thing about criticism, negative and positive, is what you wind up getting is another point of view about who you are. You can take it or reject it any time, that's no big deal. But it gives you a really wonderful way of looking at yourself in a holographic sense. And when I see these shrines, I know who some of them are. I don't know who others are, I mean, unless I look at the numbers and see them. I'm amazed at how much more my understanding of you guys is fleshed out by seeing it, how I see things in there that I never would have noticed before. I see things there that I'm sure some of you never even noticed before as well. I'd like to know how many people were surprised by their own shrines. How were you surprised by them? Anyone want to just jump in there?
When I started out, it was nothing like it ended. My first ideas and putting it all together were totally different. And the more I started looking at it, the more ideas I picked up, and the final result was totally different. And I'm happier, a lot happier with my final result than it was with the first idea.
Great. Theo, I think I saw your hand.
Well, after I started working on it, well, I sat down and wrote a free write on what I thought it should be. And basically, that's what it became. And after the working on it was not the changing or... When I was building it and really didn't have any choice on what I was doing, I felt. It's like it told me what it wanted to be. And I really didn't have any choice on where things went. And that was really an unusual feeling to feel this thing was an identity of its own. That I was just the builder with a passive builder.
Mm-hmm. How many had that same experience with the kind of life of its own? Raise your hands high so I can see. A couple of you. Most of you still felt very much in control of it then? It happened as you wanted it to?
Nothing came to me for the first, I thought hard about it the first 3 days, and nothing at all came to me. And then all of a sudden, just one thing came to me, and I just started working, and the other things came to me. I didn't pre-write about it beforehand. It just kind of, you know, one thing led to another. I came to a dead end. I couldn't figure out what to do. You know, I was searching for a ping pong ball to use as a head for my little doll, and all of a sudden I thought, you know, I just thought about that picture, and I used that instead. In that sense, I liked the song, but not in the sense that it controlled things, just kind of happened.
Did you notice anything in common with the experience of solving this problem, which probably caused a lot of you a great deal of anxiety at one moment or another, to the way Russell Baker finally solved some of his problems? What was one of the words we used to define how Russell Baker solved his problem? The swimming problem, the flying problem, the getting Mimi to love him problem.
He just sort of just jumped in and did it, and then
things were happening. Yeah, surrender. I think that more often than not, the thing that stops a person from solving a problem is getting so afraid of it that they don't just jump right in and see what happens. We all have, at some level, there's a kind of piece of us that says we are not capable of solving the problem, which is what happened with Russell Baker. And finally, he had to realize that he had to solve the problem or die, and he did. In this particular case, you had to solve the problem or die, too. In this particular course, you had no option. You took the course, you were here, there it was, you had to do it. And you all pulled through, I think, real well. Does anyone want to talk about bears or talk about any specific shrine? Of course, that's always a painful question.
What?
Let's have Brent first.
There were some shrines that evoked a lot more feelings in me than others. And those were the ones I tried to pick out to write on as the optional ones. Mm-hmm. And I sat down and I thought, what am I doing? This is harder than I thought it was. And I don't know, I also found myself trying to guess what each of the symbols meant. And I was struggling with that and with the feelings I had. But overall, it's like some of these are really powerful. And I just hope that I have a chance to talk to the person who made it so I can just kind of figure out.
Would you want to take this opportunity to talk about any of them, or would you rather not right now?
Well, I don't think I have time here, but.
Right, so what for? You want to say something, Kai?
Well, it's just similar things. It's something that I really struggled with it. It's almost like I thought I should think of, you know, some thing that would be useful or something good that people have to be able to take from it, and I just kind of stopped, but I couldn't think of anything. I just sat down here and I was going to do this one, and right here I was just looking at this one, and suddenly this one, I think it's Kathleen, hit me with a lot of meaning that suddenly that I kind of things that I didn't think about putting into a shrine but I thought were really good. I don't know, can I talk about that?
If you really want to talk about it, Kai, why don't you take a
The first impression I got, I looked and I saw the boxes and they're all separate and they kind of just reminded me of the little births and deaths that were kind of being able to be included in childhood, which we talked about, but I didn't think about doing it on my own. And then the hands reaching up. The way I saw it was, I don't know, just somebody who's reaching or trying really hard to get to these four important goals or, you know, ideals that they can't quite get to, and that they're almost struggling with, but that they at least seem to have those four things as being really clear that they know they want to reach. That's just the thing that I got. I haven't even looked inside. Mm-hmm.
One thing too we'll notice as we're looking at these shrines and are moved by them is that a lot of what we see in them is ourselves, not so much the person who made them. Mm-hmm. I think that's one of the most wonderful things about art is somebody else's communication sends us deeper into our own selves. Go ahead.
I think that part of the stuff that clicks when what people were talking about of how some of the shrines really hit them, you know, and they had a lot of feeling for them, and then some of them they had a hard time with. And I know for me, things that I picked up on that were inside me, I could write tons on. That was really true for me.
Again, this concept of mirroring.
It's true that everything else I was saying, because I guess the one that was probably most powerful to me was the black one here. And it's kind of funny because after I got my journal back, reviewed it, I had a few dreams about black people. And Lori, you wrote, "What significance do black people have to you?" And I don't know what it is yet, but I guess just the pinnacles there, the sharp points, and the hardness, and the enclosure, and then inside there's a little, you know, girl in there. I don't know, just for me it evoked a lot of power.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm not sure what that is. It was really powerful.
I think that you brought up a really good point about some of the invocations we get in some of these pieces. We don't know what they are. We don't sort of have a label for them. And I think it's perfectly okay to not be able to express them. But if you can't express them, don't leave it alone. I mean, it doesn't mean you have to think about it every minute, but sort of keep that on the back burner and let it kind of percolate down until finally when all the water evaporates, there's this crystal left that you can look at and possibly describe. What Kate said about the mirroring, I think, was real, real important. That in this class, sometimes Kate and I get this idea to do something that seems to be right, and we do it. Oftentimes, we don't necessarily think about all the ways it becomes relevant, but somehow it manages to always do that. How many times have we experienced a Vespers that led directly into the next day's subject matter? I mean, I just think that life is an amazing example of mirroring if we know how to look at it. Does anyone else have anything else to add? Sometimes it's a little tough to talk about this stuff, but there's just so much going on and we need a little time to digest it. It's always a real powerful time for me when a project, an art project is brought in. Much more powerful, I think, than journals, because we have less control over our visualization, our imaging, than we have with our words. So all kinds of stuff starts sneaking out. And when we put them all together into one big group, we get a real kind of collective feel for what's going on. And I often feel like I'm more like a ship at sea riding sometimes a very rough surface. And I keep plunging in real deep, and I have to keep coming up for air. And that sometimes makes it real, real hard to talk about.
Sorry, how do you want to handle the sharing of the notes? Since they haven't had a chance to resonate with their own shrine.
Well, I think maybe what I could get there.
I would suggest maybe just kind of like set them right by the shrine and then the person when they want to look at it can look at it and then they don't have to look at the paper.
Okay, that's a good enough idea, but I think what we need to do before we do that is to organize these things so that we get most of the shrines in, so they're not sort of all scattered out. I mean, this is community space, so I want to be able to leave some room while they're here for it to be used. So maybe we can condense them. We can take the books and things off here, and we can probably put another shrine, some of the smaller shrines in place here.
As sort of bittersweet and more on the bitter side, is that true?
Yeah, there's a lot of pain in there. But that's why I was afraid that would be too... Sometimes it depends on my mood when I do things, and sometimes they'll turn out more, you know, negative than how I feel on most normal days or something. But I felt pretty, you know, good when I did my shrine, and so that's why I did all those hearts, because for me, though I had a very painful childhood, you know, growing up and everything, and right now I'm dealing with some stuff with my family and stuff,
for me, I have always had so much love to give inside of me, and I have felt so much love for other people, especially my family, and they have given me so much love. And that's why I cut out all those lots of hearts and put them on there, and I did them in the rainbow colors, because for me, I wanted to put a rainbow on it, but I wanted to think of a neat way to do it, and that's how I did it, because for me, the rainbow, like in the Bible, how it symbolizes hope, you know, and a promise and everything, that's what it means for me. And so that's why I did that, because I thought that would maybe even everything out, because I don't feel bitter. Mm-hmm. I mean, I feel pain, but I try not to carry, I mean, that's not a big part of, I mean, it's a big part of me, but there's also a lot more, you know. And I think that I'm coming to a more healthier balance in my own life, you know. And there was a time, like these last few years, there has been sort of an imbalance for me, just because when I left my family, I had to face a lot of issues that I had been burying for a long time. And so, you know, there was sort of an imbalance there for a while, but I feel like I'm getting to a real healthy place, you know. I mean, and it's a long process. It's a journey, you know. And I think it's something that doesn't happen overnight, and it's sort of something that you work with your whole life, you know. But
the music is cool, and it's a good song.
I picked words just out of a lot of different songs. Some of that reflects just the way, what I said before about how I feel very strongly for people, lots of people. I mean, most all people, I don't know, I just do. But there have been periodically some very special people in my life besides my family that have made me feel special or made me feel good. And some of those songs are sort of dedicated to them, you know.
That one face doesn't have anything on it.
The one with the tears, that one?
Yeah.
I put the cardboard one in there with the smile, and the eyes are white with nothing in them, because they're to symbolize, when I was little, my parents always said, everybody comments on your big blue eyes and everything, and how alert you were in the hospital, and all the surgeries you had and everything, they always could tell that you were okay because by your eyes were bright, you know, and stuff like that. And slowly, this is really interesting, but a friend of mine showed me this. He had some pictures, and he had his baby picture, and then he had a picture of himself like in elementary school sometime, and he looked at the two eyes, and it was like, you could see such a vast change from being the happy baby and everything, and not feeling bad about yourself or about your life or just sad about anything or building walls or anything. And then you see this child, you know, 6, 7, 8 years down the road, and it's like there's no life behind the eyes, you know. And that's how I sort of built up to that point. And so that's why the eyes are white on both the masks. And then on the one that has the smile and everything, that was like my outside appearance. My mom put a lot of pressure on me. Well, both my parents did, you know. And I was like the be happy kid, no matter how tough it got, you know, put a smile on your face and, you know, go with the flow and be strong and everything, and it'll all wash out, you know, in the end. And then the other face with the tears and no mouth on it and no nose. I didn't think about this until after I did it, but the no mouth and no nose is because, for me, that has been a bitter, every time I look in the mirror, I face that, and I, about myself, I don't know if you noticed up there, there's a picture of a child with a cleft lip and palate from the nursing books. That's what everybody thought was steady. It looked so good, but I wasn't. And then there's a little suture kit that has the needle and the thread, and I got that from the nurse too, but those signified part of my pain from my childhood, you know. And I have just been able to recently face, I mean, I couldn't face that I didn't want to look in the mirror at myself, you know, and that I didn't, I mean, I couldn't admit that to myself. It's like, no, you can handle this, you know. I mean, and then sometimes I'd wake up, I'm sure everybody has this, these kind of days, but it's like, I don't want to see another mirror. I don't want to ever look at myself again, you know. Don't show me that. And I think that I left out the mouth and the nose because those are the quote-unquote imperfect part, you know, flawed features of my face that I don't, and they show the imperfect parts of me, and I, you know, that's on the outside. And so I didn't like that, so I think that's why I left it off. And the tears are for the pain that I felt inside that I never let out.
Lisa, in the top, there's a lot of pictures. There's one that says illusions, and then there's, like, the two wedding bands that are cut apart mm-hmm. and two people that are cut apart. Mm-hmm. And when I looked at it, I thought of, like, broken dreams and broken promises. Did you think that there was a lot?
There's a whole lot more than just the marriage thing in there, yeah.
Yeah, no, I didn't figure out your childhood engagement.
The illusion, no. My parents.
Oh, okay.
That, you know, some people wrote in my comments, you know, I see a divorce or whatever, and that's true. But that has just happened, like, in the recent past. That mm-hmm. is not from my childhood.
Right.
The book and the illusions and the brokenness, you know, the broken home and the broken, all that stuff is, that's all, those are all broken. Yeah, you picked up on that. That's,
no, I just, if there's like,
if there's
that
more.
And then like the doll holding the balloon, sort of this like hope, I don't know,
uh-huh.
this feeling of like, you kept hoping and something kept tearing it apart. You kept hoping. And there's always, you know, love and and your songs and stuff, but even some of the songs had like a melancholy and
uh-huh.
sort of a, you know, I love you, but things keep getting broken.
I can't have it. That's how I feel I've always felt about love in my life. Like, I can give it so much, but the love that I give is not perfect enough, it's not pure enough, it's not the best kind of love that I could give, and I could keep improving that till the day I die. I mean, you know, I could keep getting on myself about that, and I mean, that's, you know, I have to let some of that go. I want to be the best lover that there is. I mean, because I feel so much for people. And then the love that I get, I always feel like sort of that feeling of it's right there, but you can't quite get it. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And that's what a lot of that, maybe that melancholy stuff that you picked up is. Because that's how I've always felt. I've always felt like it's brushed me, but I can't seem to get a hold of it.
Anyone else? Did you want to add anything to that?
One song she didn't put on there, and a lot of the songs she sings, she has a beautiful voice, wonderful roommate, but one song she didn't put on there that I think represents her life a lot, and I know it's a favorite, is by the Carpenters, and it's Why Must We Go On Hurting Each Other? And I kind of wish she would put on there, but it's her shrine.
Yeah, I think I did put it on put part of the words on it on the back underneath my family's name. But I didn't put the whole thing. I mean, I didn't put the title or anything. I mean, yeah.
Maybe you could sing it for us.
Maybe. Just come by my room when I have the Walkman on. You can hear it. I don't know if anybody picked up on this, but there was one thing that I felt like might be not confusing for people, but sort of out of place with the whole rest of it, and that was the picture of the Gucci perfume inside. I just have to sort of explain that. That for me was, I don't know, I thought of a whole bunch of things when I put that in there. One was that I don't feel very pretty lots of times, and so that, I mean, like, my girlfriend bought me a really expensive bottle of Calvin Klein perfume that I wear often, and that makes me feel pretty, you know, sometimes. And so that's why I couldn't find, you know, what the exact one that I wanted or whatever, but that represented it. Another thing is that part of me is this stereotypical, I don't know if any of you girls will agree with this, but a lot of people think PLU girls are just rich bitches, and part of me is really like that. I want the best, I deserve the best, I'm gonna get it, you know, in my life, and that sort of symbolized that materialistic part of me that I think a lot of people want, or not a lot, at least myself. Part of me, and I really fight against that, especially up here. I mean, it's like, let it go, babe.
And what else could the perfume symbolize instead of materialism?
And I thought I could just say that your parents always wanted, and your mom especially wanted to be their little glamour girl and their
perfect
pretty daughter. Little girl. And I thought I saw that as even when you were a kid, you know, be pretty, you know.
It's not so much with being pretty, it was more the perfect thing. I mean, it doesn't matter. My parents were always, it doesn't matter what you look like on the outside. I mean, it matters. They knew that. But, I mean, you have so many other things to give. You're so insightful and you're so smart. And it was like trying to build me up for my makeup for the part that I didn't have or something like that.
Lisa's choice of perfume, however, is her own. And what kind of gift is she giving herself in that, besides being a rich bitch? What else could that symbolize for her, that she's giving herself?
It's exclusive, and maybe she's kind of saying, you know, that, hey, I'm exclusive too. I mean, I'm a one of a kind, I'm valuable, I have worth.
Anything else that could help us out?
Why don't you tell us what you were thinking?
I'm just real curious as to what else perfume means.
Well, Christine said something about it.
I thought it was a mask. I mean, just another form of a mask, because I know when I wear perfume, you know, it's my mask. I mean, it's you know, like, if, yeah, it does. You know, like, if I don't take a shower, oh, better put on a little extra square perfume. And, you know, I mean, it's my mask. It's my sense of security. I mean, now it's definitely one of my forms of security. And I don't know, that's what I got out of the doll, too, is security. And I really felt, I mean, how much love you had. I could feel all the hearts and stuff. I could feel this overabundance of love. And I always felt, I don't know, I maybe it's just because I want to read this into it, because this is how I felt with my blanket when I was little. But did you give your doll a lot of love? It's like, I don't know, when I was little, I really hurt my mom because I told her that I loved my blanket more than her. I mean, that was really a powerful thing that she has brought back to me now. And that's what I get about that doll, is that you didn't want to, you gave it so much love. Do you kind of see where I'm coming from?
Uh-huh.
You gave, because it didn't talk back, and it accepted you for what you were.
Well, this is a real interesting story. I just have to tell it really quick. That's not my real doll. I had a Raggedy Ann doll, you know, and it was the traditional Raggedy Ann, but that was the closest I could come to it. What I did to my Raggedy Ann doll, and I don't know if...
How to bring the microphone closer here.
Is that I took this black indelible marker, and on her face, you know how you were saying about not talking that? I wrote my name across her forehead, except it wasn't, I couldn't write, I mean, I didn't know how to write correctly yet, and like, I wrote it sort of backwards, like the L and the S were backwards, and I wrote it from right to left instead of left to right, and it was like, it ruined her face. I mean, it wasn't, she didn't look the right way on the face. And part of that was because I wanted it to show that it was mine, because I loved it and everything. But I think a lot of it now, in the back, and it's like, now she was more like me, and that goes back to the teddy bear things and everything. I mean, that's really weird how that comes up.
Defaced.
One thing I wanted to add to it, too, is that there seems to be a real interesting mixed message. Part of it about wanting love and wanting to share love, and the other one part about putting on the good face. And when you think about perfume, I always think about how our culture reacts to all those wonderfully human things that we all have to confront anyway, but we pretend not to. For instance, that you know our bodies do emit a certain fragrance after a period of time, and we're all supposed to assume that that's horrible, or all those other sorts of ways we have of masking who we are and pretending that we are not those things in order to create an image that ultimately is not only imperfect, but is a total failure. And so oftentimes we put a lot of investment into making that image happen, and then wondering why it is we feel insecure and why it is we aren't really whole in ourselves. I just sort of think that there's that kind of mixed message that you're getting.
There is, and I give people mixed messages like that, and that's very interesting that you brought that up, because especially now, like in the last few years of my life, when I have been desiring more, I don't know if it's so much intimate contact with guys, but just special relationships with guys and stuff. And I give them real mixed messages. And it's like they want to say, "Beg you, I can't do that." And I think that's that's stuff that I need to work on, because that's really interesting.
I think also that perfume can symbolize woman, femininity, and a very sensual lovingness towards oneself. When you wear perfume, you care for yourself in some way. And I don't think it's necessarily a negative thing, but I see in this childhood shrine perfume, and it means some kind of maturity coming out.
A change.
And a change. And a real gift of sensuality, which, whether you use perfume or whether you don't, that's kind of a very heavy-duty symbol of what it means to be a woman. Look in Mademoiselle, look in Glamour, any magazine like that. What do they make the most money on? Scent. So that's a very sensual kind of symbol for me. In contrast to the doll.
I'm starting to give myself permission, I think.
I got a feeling from it that you started making it, and you had these ideas, and then that you kept feeling like there wasn't enough on it, and so you kept thinking of something more to put on it.
You know, I have to tell a small story about that too. We'll go on all day. I read that when you wrote about that, Kai, and I wrote about that last night. Number one, I just now thought of this when I saw Kathleen and she smiled. I'm very competitive towards Kathleen, and because we happen to live next door at school, and because she happens to be a brilliant senior nursing student who just is a high achiever in school, I have been that way my whole life, and so it's almost like, God, why did you let us live next to each other? Everything. I mean, because it's like, that's the last thing I need to do is be more competitive, But this woman's working on her shrine. Monday we get here and she's got it all mapped out. Face it, she's on top. She's ahead. She's already done with the next book. I mean, what can you say, And so, I don't know. It's like, okay, damn it, I gotta do good on this shrine. I'm gonna do something incredibly awesome. And so, then I started doing it. And I was like, oh dear, what am I doing? I can't believe it. I'm too excited. Well, we'll just pretend that we have this great plan and everything. So that was kind of funny. I mean, I thought about that just now when I looked at you. But I wrote last night, and part of me, how you said my shrine seemed like it was just packed with stuff. Get back to the masking type stuff. It's so much easier for me to have so much. For my whole life, I've always been like this, to have so much going on, and so much to do, and so much to deal with, and so many people to care for and take care of, and it's like a whirlwind, so that I didn't have to stop and think about myself and how I felt inside. And so I think that's really evident in just how the shrine is just so busy, and there's so much stuff, and so many symbols, and all that. I think that it provided like a sort of cushion for me, you know.
Well, on the subject of me supposedly being on top, my shrine, a lot of my, the boxes on the bottom, the four and then the little clock, almost everyone took them differently than I meant them. And I have the paper with an A, and I wrote lots in my journal about that because so many people said that's good, you know, you did good, and that is not how I meant it. I resented every A I got, and I never got A's for me. I always felt like it was a huge parental expectation to get an A in calc and an A in physics and an A in chem and work, 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 and study while the other kids are playing. So when I got to college, I actually, my sophomore year, practiced getting a C for myself, you know, purposely did bad so that I could know that it was my choice. I want the A or I don't want the A. Same with like swimming, it wasn't a happy thing. I was on the swim team and went to 4 a.m. workouts and after school workouts, and I hated it, and I finally quit and said, forget this. And all those bottom boxes were not good things, and most people put that, that I was peacefully swimming or I was this or that.
Does what these people have been saying strike a chord in any of you?
What Kathleen was saying about the grades, it made me so mad. It was like, in elementary school, someone saw that I did well on a test. And they said, you know, well, you know, what did you get on the other test? What did you get on the other test? And these kids, these stupid kids, started, I mean, passed it all the way around the room. And all of a sudden, everybody's saying things that should have been good. I mean, it should have been good that I got the high score on the test. And it was like, and they were making all these jokes and stuff, and it made me so mad. And ever since then, all through school, I tried to like play down. I mean, I told people that I would get, instead of getting a 99 on a test, I'd tell them I got an 80%. I mean, I didn't want them to think I was stupid, but I did not want to be the high score. And it made me so mad that they did that, and it was so ridiculous. I mean, it's, you're supposed to be smart, but you aren't supposed to be smarter than the average, but if you're just average, then you're average. I mean, average is it.
You want to be outstanding.
You know, and it made me so mad, these little kids. That, you know, and they were silly little things, and it made me so mad, I almost cried in class.
Does it bother you today when people ask you grades?
It doesn't make me mad when they ask me my grade. It makes me mad when they go, geez, you're so smart. Oh my God, and it's just like,
it isolates you from everyone else.
Or something. Like, I don't know, it's not fair.
I think I took that. I think I even took that to extreme where I didn't do as well because I did not want to be isolated from my friends. I think like fourth and fifth grade, I didn't do as well as I could have or should have. Just because the norm around my friends was they didn't do as well, so.
I think it's important in terms of Kathleen's shrine, to realize that there's a lot of pain there. I went through a similar sort of thing with my parents in terms of the grades and the expectations and the demands and the shoulds, you better do this and that type of stuff. But it wasn't to that extreme. And I don't know, I just think it's super neat that Kathleen can say, yeah, that's where I was at before, and yeah, it's a lot of hard work now to change, you know, and do what's good for me and feel good about that. But I'm doing it, you know, and I think that deserves some credit. I mean, you have to be sure and give yourself the amount of credit that you deserve for that, because I'm acutely aware of that struggle, and so I know some of what's going on. Yeah.